there's just not enough combat engineer capability in the IDF or anywhere else for that matter to be able to deal with what they're seeing. Subterranean is a huge force multiplier, and I think that any adversary that has the ability to do so is going to utilize it. And it's a lot of low tech versus high tech, and it's very successful low tech against high tech.
Welcome to The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Rachel Melling of the Mad Scientist team, and I'll be joined in just a minute by Kate Kilgore, intelligence analyst with TRADOC G2. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the evolution of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. Follow us on social media at Army Mad Sci, and don't forget to subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. On today's episode, we sit down with Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Hardy, TRADOC liaison officer to the Israel Defense Forces, to discuss his observations from the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel and insights into how the larger conflict is informing the Army about the operational environment. As always, the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or Training and Doctrine Command. Let's get started. All right, Ken, thank you so much for being here. We're really glad that you could join us today.
Thanks. It's a great opportunity, and I'm excited. It's the first time for me, so I think it ought to be fun.
Perfect. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
Before we get started, can you introduce yourself to our audience and describe your role as the TRADOC LNO to the IDF?
So, my name is Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Hardy. Go by Ken. I am a 48 Gulf, or a foreign area officer. I got voluntold for that, about 13, 14 years ago now. So I'm a Middle East foreign area officer that basically deals with security cooperation and international military relations with our partners in North Africa, Middle East, Arabic-speaking countries. Specifically to TRADOC, I am the liaison officer to the Israeli Defense Forces for TRADOC. So last year, we probably did 60 or more engagements, I think, that I ran with the Israeli Defense Forces writ large, specifically looking at ways that we can share with them where they can get better and ways that we can get better from learning from them. So it's a mutually learning and beneficial type relationship.
Awesome. Well, I guess we'll jump right into it. So the Israel-Hamas conflict has been going on for about 2 months now. What are you seeing in the conflict so far? Like, what kinds of capabilities are being predominantly used? What are the differences between the capabilities of the IDF and Hamas? And what are some takeaways from that?
So for the last couple of months, the actual kinetic action, conflict's been going on long time. But the actual kinetic actions has been going on since 7 October. It's low tech versus high tech again. I don't want to say 90% of the same stuff we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan. I personally never made it over to Afghanistan, but I got some experience there in Iraq. And it's a lot of low tech versus high tech. And it's very successful low tech against high tech. That just really keeps coming back. I mean, when you look at the capabilities that are being used on the Israeli side, again, you guys know anything about Task Force Odin? As an intel guy, prior intel guy, I got voluntold for intel coming in too, thinking I was going to jump out of planes and all that stuff. And I spent a lot of time in buildings with no windows. As an intel guy, Task Force Odin was finally like, yay, intel finally going to drive maneuver. Instead of maneuver, driving intel, which, it happens. Let's be honest. It's the Army. We can be honest with ourselves. So Israel uses a lot of its high-tech stuff, specifically for the targeting aspects, the targeting of the leadership and those that they've been able to identify. And they're doing actually a pretty phenomenal job of being able to target and minimize a lot of collateral damage. I have to give them credit for that. They've been doing a great deal with that. But the high-tech stuff also in that regard is great, but so much, especially for the maneuver forces, it's just low-tech stuff that is really countering any type of high-tech capabilities you have out there. And when it comes to boots on the ground, you can have your little sensors and drones and all that stuff covering down for you, but it's still kind of a man-on-man force. Even with armor and trophy and systems like that, they have developed just simple TTPs in order to get over and overcome those things so that they can still have catastrophic kills on the Merkava, which is one of the most heavily armored tanks in the world. Even with the trophy systems and things like that, they're able to find simple, redundant ways to overcome, millions and billions of dollars worth of technology.
And so when you talk about some of those simple TTPs for targeting some of Israel's high-tech systems and hardened systems, what are a couple that stand out to you specifically, some of those ways that Hamas is using those low-tech means to get around those high-tech capabilities?
I would say one thing is like the trophy system, the vehicle protection systems that we have for our armored systems and things like that. It can only handle, you know, so much at a certain point in time, right? And so they've developed basically ways to ambush things with multiple RPGs coming in at different times and different venues to essentially overwhelm, if you will, or to trick the system. And so, and even still, it can only have so many, take so many hits before it's obsolete and you can actually start penetrating the armor. And so they realize all you have to do is keep hitting that same spot, you know, with a couple of RPGs and you eventually get in. And so what they use, again, like with the tunnels, especially with the tunnels, they can pop up from anywhere, have a couple RPGs here, one RPG there, and just within a matter of minutes, if not a few seconds, they can actually have a breach in that hull, that Merkava, and that crew is now either severely wounded or potentially catastrophically killed. So
it sounds a lot like what we saw with the initial attack on October 7th with the saturation salvos coming from the Hamas operatives in Gaza to overwhelm the Iron Dome air defenses.
Yeah, and that's something, having lived through that for that first week and a half before we evacuated, yeah, it's a real thing. It absolutely happens. Again, and these rockets that they're doing, if you look at the math, the rockets that Hamas is producing, you know, $500-$600 a piece. Just the Iron Dome interceptors alone, like the lower level interceptors that they're using, we're talking $50,000 to $60,000, right? So on an order of magnitude, 100 times more expensive to protect than it is to produce something. Yeah, or even the small drones. They're still using small drones and things like that. I was going to get into that maybe later. But the little small off-the-shelf drone that you can use, and literally you just go and you drop a grenade. If you look at a lot of the video footage from 7 October, that's one of the ways they overcame a lot of the high-tech security systems. So the border with Gaza there is crazy armed. I mean, they've got, not only do they have like a no man's land and they have like fences and all this other stuff, but they had cameras and FLIR. They had actually a like CROW system, like a remotely operated weapon systems, you know, to protect the soldiers. Soldiers can use standoff and use these things on towers. And Hamas was able to just fly little drones along the ground, up and over, drop in bombs and take all that stuff out and essentially just blinded many areas that were breached later on. So again, I mean, this is stuff that can be bought right off the shelf and can be easily procured and easily utilized to drop a small little bomblet on something and take out a multi-$1,000 operational system.
So it's really great to talk to you because I feel like we have a, you know, a firsthand account of someone who was there on 7 October. And like you said before, this conflict is not 2 months old. It's many, many years old, and it was going on long before October 7th. But I wanted to ask you more about what has surprised you now about this conflict and what are some of the differences than what we've been seeing. So what are some of the things that you're seeing on the battlefield that may be different than what we expected?
Just a little drone usage, like I was just getting into, actually. Perfect segue. Just, you know, back in the day, it was a sniper. A sniper can bog down, you know, up to a battalion, demoralize it and really slow you down. Now they're just using little drones, right? And with the huge advantage they have in the subterranean world, they can pop up anywhere at any time from any location, throw a drone up, go back down into their hiding places and still utilize that drone to go and just drop a few little bombs here or there. And the effect that it has on the forces is just huge because you can't really stop it. You know, we have all these protect systems and things like that. These, again, spending millions and millions of dollars. But at the end of the day, you have to be able to find the spider hole the guy's coming out of to stop the drone from coming up, even if you can find it and shoot it before it drops something. Just these little things that are just kind of wearing on the forces there and things like that. Surprised me about the conflict. The barbarity, probably, on 7 October. If I can say that word, I guess. I don't know what else. Heinousness. Not only that, but just the scale of it. You see this stuff in combat. We saw a lot, again, like I saw stuff in Iraq. Had a lot of friends who saw a lot in Iraq and Afghanistan both. Just the level and the actual barbarity surprised me.
Has any of this changed after this shift from standoff to ground operations in Gaza?
I will say this. They are doing a great job at integrating their air and their land forces. That's huge. And kudos to them. Because, I mean, in Iraq and Afghanistan, we didn't have that down pat ourselves. Because a call for fire in the Air Force, you know, from a guy sitting up there holding a stick and writing stuff down was very different from a call for fire from the ground forces. For us, the first thing you do is you give your location. And we know, don't shoot there. The Air Force is the exact opposite. All they care about, just tell me where to shoot. So the first grid they get, they're like writing it down. Okay, that's where I shoot, you know. You learn through these things. So they have been doing a great job, I think, of really going through and learning how to integrate air and ground assets together. Because for them, even helicopters, if it flies at all, it's a part of the Air Force. They don't even have any type of close combat air or anything like that like we have with attack aviation. That's all for them in the Air Force. So you're talking about a complete purple operation anytime they do anything like that. I think two is just the integration of other assets as well. They love the D9 Dozer right now. Those things are huge. Engineering assets are being utilized heavily because of the threat that's coming out. So you have a lot of destruction and rubble, which you don't have to clear that per se, like you would like going through room by room by room in a house. But now you have areas that you can't maneuver through with your vehicles unless you clear a path. And even then, just because you don't have to clear a house or a room, you still have to clear that block. That block is just now massive amounts of rubble in some areas where there's a lot of Hamas leadership and stuff. And they actually even had like different layers of certain locations that were used specifically for ambushes and stuff. So pretty much vacant houses that were specifically utilized for just being there and getting in the way to try and intentionally slow the forces that they came through. And they've learned a few of those things over time as well. Some of the TTPs that Hamas used, utilizing the structures itself in Gaza. They come into the city, that first layer is really just a bunch of empty homes that is just there to use for cover and protect for, you know, an ambush force. They then go under their tunnels and move back to a separate location where they would then try and ambush the forces as they come into the city and kind of get bottlenecked or choked up into certain areas. And they try and ambush there. And then if that doesn't work, again, they retreat back into the tunnels and do one final layer, if you will, of a strong point defense. The use of, and unfortunately, civilian infrastructure and at times the civilian population themselves, it's hard. It's hard. I've fielded some RFIs from some colleagues back there. They're like, what do you do when you've got 100 kids coming up swarming a tank? You know, that's one of the things they've been faced with was they'll send the children and others up there to try and get them, one, to either try and get them to shoot them so they can catch them on camera, or to try and see and probe and see if they can slip bombs on, you know, just kind of like things we saw again in Iraq, if they can utilize, again, human shields, especially children at times, to do nefarious acts against the army. So they have an APC, it's called a Namr. It's a big Merkava tank, but instead of a turret, you've got it hollowed out inside and it's an armored personnel carrier. But essentially you have to go, you know, in between these two little areas, a couple of feet to get to the actual door. And they were using that again, using his kids or someone else to come out of a hiding spot from the rubble and under a tunnel, come up with a charge, use a simple type of glue, stick it right on the door, which is the most vulnerable part of it. And then they run off and blow the door, and then they're able to, you know, infiltrate that way. And the IDF came up with really simple things similar to what we did. And it was one of the suggestions that we had for them as well, going through the Center for Army Lessons Learned and CALL and stuff like that. I've been working with them on a lot of these requests for information. Lubricant. Just get some non-flammable, as the Marines learned in Iraq, but using lubricant. So they started greasing up this door. So that way, whenever they try and stick, you know, these bombs on it, they would just slide down. So again, low-tech things to protect a high-value asset or a high-price asset. What we wind up using again is, you know, some type of non-flammable lubricant. Low-tech against low-tech is almost what it boils down to at times.
You mentioned a lot of the implications of operating in that densely populated urban environment. Something that we've been seeing is some of the informational implications of that as well. Do you have any insights into how the information conflict kind of plays into potentially how Hamas is operating or how some of their TTPs are forcing the Israel Defense Forces to operate?
Oh, absolutely. So I think there's, and you see it mostly in the international pressure. Israel is extremely sensitive to international pressure because they want to always make sure that they are on the right side of the law, if you will. International law, things like that. They're like, hey, these guys aren't abiding by it, but we are. Please understand that our hands are being tied because of this. And the civilians on the battlefield is a huge issue. That was one of the RFI's requests for information that I received as well. You know, how do we deal with this? And there's no simple answer to that, unfortunately, especially when the population itself is being utilized or weaponized in a certain way, even at times against their own will. You know, there's non-kinetic means with like blast horns and things like that they can try and utilize. You know, we gave them some of those. Again, the lubricants on the APCs, just make sure it's not flammable so they can't come and actually climb up, you know, onto things or send little kids to climb up onto stuff. They can't stick the charges in the back of the door of their APCs like they were doing. You know, they've had success with that, and the stuff's, you know, sliding off and then it blows up behind them. And again, the subterranean thing too. Like one of the things they found in the subterranean realm is Hamas is still looking at not just killing, but if they can, to capture and exploit hostages. And so they found that some of the tunnels that they have uncovered before they destroy them, they actually are like done in a way that allows for ambushes inside, and not just an ambush to kill, but literally designed to be able to grab someone and take them off to a side chute and keep them alive so that they can be used as a bargaining chip later on. One thing that can be noted is Hamas and other organizations are always learning. They're always learning. Like I said, lessons observed doesn't mean it's lessons learned. And one of the things that they have actually found is that they were actually utilizing lessons learned and writings from the Viet Cong and Vietnam against U.S. forces, translated into Arabic. So they're using things like that to know and understand, like just the way they build the tunnels. You know, if you build a tunnel straight, it's much easier to collapse and implode. If you build it with, you know, twists, turns, kind of a zigzag thing, it stops the blast. Not only is it good for, you know, having to go through more methodically like you would clearing a room or a house, it's more dangerous for the invading force if you were to go into the tunnel that way with twists and turns, but also it stops the blast. And so it's going to be less damage. You can blow the front up, but then you have the rest of the tunnel still stays intact. They have found some things in which they find an entrance to a tunnel and it's like, it's big, it's elaborate. They're like, whoa, we got something big here. This is, yeah, we got the mother load. And then it turns out to be nothing. While on the flip side of that coin, they have tunnels that are very unassuming at the beginning. But then as they get into the complex, it is a massive control center, heavily utilized by leadership, they think, or something else. A lot of those they found near the hospitals and other civilian infrastructure kind of being protected by that as well. So, but again, it's the mind games that they play. Oh, this is something simple. Don't worry about it. Just move on.
Yeah, it's that deception piece of it.
Absolutely.
And I think the tunnels are, you know, something that's different from the urban environment of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, where we haven't really seen that as much. Did they take what they saw in the Russia-Ukraine conflict and incorporate that?
I can't say that I've honestly seen much from the Russia-Ukraine lessons learned, but definitely just from previous things with Israel, as well as with other Western allies, again, in the back to World War II, Japan and using tunnels and things of that nature. It's really a big deal for them when it comes to protection.
Right. Really learning from other conflicts. Do you think that they have pulled any lessons learned from the Russia-Ukraine conflict into their operations now?
You're always going to be looking out. I know the UAV threat is real. And I think that Israel is very cognizant of that, not necessarily with Hamas right now, but with the larger Iranian threat that they face, specifically with Hezbollah. Hezbollah has been kind of throwing some stuff out there. Even before we left, Hezbollah started throwing some drones and other things up from the northern border. You have the Houthis now, which completely surprises me. Completely surprises me that the Houthis are getting this involved, where they were shooting, at times, they some pretty massive barrages of these one-way attack drones, you know, all the way from Yemen. So that threat, I think, is still there because they see Ukraine is having to deal with it from Russia every day. Hamas doesn't quite have that ability yet, but I do think that other Iranian proxies and regional actors, Hezbollah being one, the Houthis do, but, you know, they've got a little bit of standoff from that they can look at. But it still is a threat that they are looking at right now, and they are learning from now. It's just not applying to the Hamas conflict per se.
You brought up Hezbollah and the Houthis. What kinds of potential implications do you see for the wider regional temperature situation when it comes to the IDF's potential large involvement in Gaza, what that means for the West Bank, and what that means for other potential smaller or larger funded extremist organizations in the region?
Scary. Can I just say that right? Scary, honestly. So what you don't necessarily hear so much of is right now the West Bank is actually very, very active. So even before October 7th, the levels of violence and things like that that were in Israel and in those areas was probably on par, if not greater than the second intifada itself. But they weren't calling it intifada, but the levels of violence that was actually occurring was at least on par, if not maybe even a little bit elevated from that. Right now, you don't hear a lot about it because the focus is all on Gaza and the humanitarian situation and things like that. But there is absolutely an uptick in violence in the West Bank right now. With the release of a lot of the Hamas prisoners and things like that, I think there probably will be some additional instigations. That's not going away anytime soon. When it comes to Hezbollah up on the northern border, that was always my biggest fear when we were there, was whether or not they were going to strike as well once Israel got more heavily involved and focused heavily in Gaza. Comforting to say, I guess, that no one really knew that Hamas was going to do what they did. They kept phenomenal OPSEC. Operational security was amazing on that one, even for an organization like Hamas. And so it really kind of surprised Iran and Hezbollah when that actually happened. Now, however, you can see the news and you see these guys in the same room talking to each other. So, yeah, I would definitely say there is some communication and connection now. Hezbollah itself is much larger and a much better equipped and probably trained organization than is Hamas. And the implications of that are profound. They could do a lot more damage, substantially more damage than Hamas did even on October 7th. The slaughter that occurred on 7 October was about 15 or 16 times larger per capita for such a small state of Israel as September 11th. So you'd be looking at really if our September 11th included about 45,000 people. And the scary part, too, is just, again, the personal nature at which these people were killed. It wasn't a plane flying into a building that the building dropped on accident. I don't mean to trivialize that by any means, but that's what scares me, is just that kind of mentality and that kind of success, if you will, in a terrorist act that was so large and broad scale. And if other organizations in the region then kind of are bolstered by that and want to try and take advantage. I hope not. And I think that's one of the reasons we have two carrier strike groups sitting off the coast, running around in the region, still hanging out, just to make sure that doesn't happen.
So shifting a little bit, are you seeing any new technology being employed or existing technology being used in novel ways? And on top of technology, what about TTPs?
I think a lot of old stuff has been dusted off, honestly. Talking with some of the Israelis, one of the things that they were struggling with at first was integration of light and heavy forces in an urban environment. Along with that is this integration of engineering forces with them in an urban environment. Because they found, too, that maneuver units, just your standard run-of-the-mill infantry and armor units, are having to deal with these really complicated combat engineering tasks, dealing with the tunnels or dealing with obstacle clearance and stuff like that. And so one of the things that our LNO here was back in Gaza helping with, he was helping the maneuver forces teach them how to deal with tunnels, teach them how to deal with some of these obstacles that they're facing. Because there's just not enough combat engineer capability in the IDF or anywhere else for that matter to be able to deal with what they're seeing. You know, one battalion area of operations may have, you know, 100, 200, 300 tunnels in their area of operations, even in such a small location. And then you put on top of that, it's half of them are covered in rubble, or you've got rubble here, you've got rubble there, you've got other infrastructure that's booby-trapped. You've got all this stuff that you have to deal with, all the civilians and the civilian infrastructure you're trying not to damage, but it's still being utilized as a shield by Hamas. So how do you protect that while you still maneuver in? They have had to kind of do some train the trainer with their engineers in order to provide force multipliers for their combat and their maneuver units, the infantry and armor guys. What is air superiority? I guess is a question I have, too. Just thinking of some of these things, too. What, by our own doctrine, you know, especially after Iraq and Afghanistan, like we assume air superiority. And even in this conflict, Israel has air superiority, but they have it to a certain level. One, they don't have air superiority in that they can't stop little drones or some other small things coming in at their troops that are on the ground. You can't stop that. Secondly, there's still like a ceiling there that they have that you have to watch out for combat aviation, you know, rotary wing or something like that coming in, because it can still get shot down. So they still have to have an exercise standoff, even with this current conflict. So that's kind of one of my questions, especially for TRADOC. What is our doctrine? What is our thought process? When we say air superiority, you know, we might need to look at redefining that. What is air superiority? And then what is acceptable risk to our troops on the ground? And then you got the low tech versus high tech again, with the Israelis going back to low tech means to protect their high tech stuff against low tech threats. And then subterranean, again, subterranean is a huge force multiplier against the IDF right now.
So something we talk a lot about is the growing transparency of the battlefield as well. And in your opinion, how much of this conflict is influenced by the ability to see the IDF's attempts to maneuver versus Hamas's ability to use the terrain to hide not just buildings, but subterranean as well? Does that have any impact on the IDF's ability to maneuver? Is there a measure of battlefield transparency that is just inherent to urban conflict in modern combat?
I'm afraid there is. And I think we're experiencing that both in Ukraine and with this conflict right now. There's just only so much you can do. From both sides, using high-tech stuff to try and find and identify enemy targets or to guide your forces on the ground, it works, but then at the same time, it doesn't. Again, talking about the subterranean as a force multiplier, again, the way that they're utilizing these tunnels, they come up, they shoot, do an ambush of some sort, whether it's a diversion or not, and then they retreat back in. So they have spaces and periods of time in which, you know, they're blind. But the maneuvering force is also blind because they're reacting to it and trying to find out where that came from. And so they will then, you know, reset into a deeper fashion or a different advantage point, pop up again, do something different. Again, the maneuver force has to react to that, and then they pop back down. And then they move into a different location. A lot of times, like the first, second, and then your third line of defense for Hamas seems to be like a strong point, if you will, where that's the final battle. They hope to have slowed you to, you know, busted up your maneuver formation, done as much damage as possible. And that's kind of like the last line of defense for Hamas. So they have certain periods in there where they're technically blind, but they're also covered and concealed. But at the same time, for the maneuvering forces, you have all, it's kind of like Task Force Odin, right? You have a complete soak and saturation of overhead sources, but they are still limited in what they can do and where they can operate because you have limited assets and resources on the battlefield. There's no perfect answer. And at some point, we are going to have to, unfortunately, accept risk. We just have to mitigate it as best we can. Speaking with some colleagues again back in Israel, they're kind of like, you know, they came up with these $500 rockets to shoot at us. So we came up with $1 million systems, Iron Dome. So like, okay, well, they can shoot rockets, but, you know, we're fine. We're good. So what do they do next? Well, we're going to come at them underground. We're going to do the tunnels. And what did Israel do? They came up with ways to find and detect and then destroy tunnels. So like, they can't get to us over the air. They can't get to us under the ground. We're safe. And then Hamas literally walked across, you know, breached defenses and came across while using everything else at the same time. A lesson learned, hopefully for us from this, not just observed, is that we can't rest on our laurels. You know, we can't just assume that we are good to go. There's no stopping. There's no stopping the innovation. There's no stopping the thought processes. And we have to continue to look at, again, low tech. Don't ever put that to the side. Don't focus so much on high tech wizardry that we forget the reality that we will be faced and that can still hurt us.
We talk a lot with the Russia-Ukraine conflict about being able to out-adapt your adversary. It sounds a lot like that's kind of what you've characterized, as well as being able to out-adapt the force that you're fighting against and still be able to draw upon the things that you learned in conflicts against them and other people's conflicts as well. So I think that segues pretty well into that last question. While we understand it's still relatively early in this version of the kinetic conflict that we're seeing between Israel and Hamas, what lessons do you think the U.S. military needs to learn from this conflict?
Again, to harp on it, low tech is still important. We have to be able to find quick, adaptable, low-tech means to develop to protect our high-tech against their low-tech threats. That's something that we can't forget. We absolutely can't forget that. The other question, again, I go back to, what is air superiority? Define it and maybe clarify it a little bit. And again, understand what we might have to do. Again, that transparent battlefield, it's an open battlefield. And we're not going to be able to control everything all the time. subterranean is a huge force multiplier. And I think that any adversary that has the ability to do so is going to utilize it. I mean, one of the big things that I always discuss with the Israelis there, looking at their doctrine versus ours, they're focused internally, essentially, you know, just maybe a few kilometers off their border. That's all they do. We're an expeditionary. We're a globally expeditionary force. So we never fight on our home turf. We're always fighting on someone else's turf. And that means that they would be able to utilize that subterranean aspect, I think, in huge ways against us. And then back to the standard maneuver units are really going to have to not only become more adaptable, but they're going to have to be able to deal with a lot of stuff that we have specialized units that typically do. You know, we're going back to the division as a maneuver, as a fighting force, but I think we're still going to have to kind of plus up some of those things that we got rid of, not just the air defense. Let's be honest, we gutted ourselves in air defense. Appropriations, it wasn't necessary. We needed money elsewhere. I totally understand that. And we're trying to correct that as fast as we can. But I think some of these other things, like the subterranean piece with our engineers, that's going to be huge too. I think our engineers are going to have a larger portion of the fight right now than we may anticipate as well, just looking at what's going on in Israel with Hamas right now. So again, we're fighting on someone else's territory, not our own.
Just to kind of cover our bases here, these lessons, in your opinion, do they translate both to counterinsurgency type conflicts and large-scale combat operations?
100%. Absolutely. And not only that, I think no matter what we do in a large scale conflict, because I do think that's where we need to be focused. But at the same time, there's always going to be a hybrid threat involved. There's no getting away from that now. There's absolutely no getting away from a hybrid threat, whether it's large scale or counterinsurgency. I think we're going to be still dealing with the same things. And we adapted quite well, I think, too. In the early days of Iraq and Afghanistan, I think we adapted pretty well, at least teaching the doctrines and TTPs at the schoolhouse, where we were still focusing. I remember going through the captain's career course back at Fort Huachuca, and we went through the HIC, high-intensity conflict, LISCO conflict, high-intensity conflict and LISCO stuff, and we immediately transitioned into LIC, the low-intensity conflict, counterinsurgency operations, things like that. They also came up with the TRADOC G2, kudos, because they came up with the hybrid threat doctrines and things like that. So it's instead of, you know, I was an intel guy, right? So I came in, we had the WEG, and I was memorizing, you know, old Soviet doctrine and battlefield, and, you know, I could, like, identify, okay, well, this one wheel on this type of APC is like right here and it's a gap. So this is going to be this, and it's going to be this kind of a unit and this, you know, all that stuff. Well, you got to kind of throw some of that out, but you can't throw it all out because you still have that large scale combat operation stuff you have to do. That's still tiered level stuff. But then you also have that hybrid threat that will never go away. It's some dude sitting on a cell phone or some teenager sitting on a cell phone, you know, walking around gathering intelligence on you and your forces that you have to account for. You can't negate that. So large scale, absolutely, we need to prepare for it, kind of an all hazards, if you will. You know, growing up in Texas and Oklahoma, we had a lot of tornadoes, right? And some of the things that people were really surprised about, at least it seemed like on the national scale, was like I was in high school when the Alfred P. Murrah building was bombed in Oklahoma City. I remember that very well. And people were surprised at how quickly we were able to kind of deal with that on the ground. Well, not me personally, I was in high school, but how the community was able to deal with such a large scale event. Like, I mean, just one building was almost completely dropped. Half of it was dropped. All the buildings damaged around it. Like, how did you clean up so fast? How did you get people out so fast? Well, because we'd been doing it for tornadoes. Now, a tornado is not a massive bomb, but there's a lot of similarities, right? So kind of an all hazards threat. We got to keep that in our doctrine. We have to have an all hazards approach, which I think we generally do pretty well with in our doctrine and our training. But we have to constantly be thinking about what we don't know. You know, Rumsfeldian here, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So try and prepare for it as best you can. But I think those are things going forward we have to do. And not only that, we have to second guess ourselves. We don't have all the answers, and we have to be humble and accept the fact that we don't have all the answers. And that will keep us looking, searching, trying new ideas, trying new things, instead of acting like we have it and we know it all. We've got to accept the fact that we don't, and we need to prepare for that. That comes to adaptability and flexibility, I think.
Before we close out, do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share?
No, I mean, this has been great. Hopefully something good comes out of it. It's been fun to talk about, and this has been fun. It's been great meeting you guys. I do hope that that we can continue and continue having these discussions, because this is huge. I mean, I'm an old guy, you know, I'll be retiring eventually. There's a new generation coming up, bright young minds, great, I don't say kids, but to me they are, you know, great youth and young Americans that we have a responsibility to hand over something to them and put them on the right track too, with the way we train them, with how we prepare them for what comes next in the world, so that they can be as prepared as possible. So yeah, it's exciting times in that regard, and look forward to hopefully helping out with that somehow.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for being with us.
This has been a great conversation. I'm sure we could just keep talking about this for forever. But we really appreciate you taking the time to share your experiences and insights in this really impactful and recent conflict. It's really, really helpful to us. So thank you.
Yeah. And thank you guys for the opportunity. So keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Hardy. You can keep up to date with all things Mad Sci by following us on social media at Army Mad Sci or visiting the blog, the Mad Scientist Laboratory at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you accessed it. This feedback helps improve future episodes of The Convergence and allows us to reach a bigger and broader audience.